I'm Kate Remington, and I'm talking with Marty O'Donnell. And normally, in these introductions, I would run down a list of credits, but I think in this case, it's just enough to say hi. It's really fantastic to be able to talk with you.
Well, hi, Kate. I appreciate your call and being on your show. This is great.
And of course, you know, I really would love to spend some time talking with you about the music and the sound design that you did for Myth and Halo and Destiny. But I'm really eager to find out more about your current project, the Kickstarter for the prequel music for the game that you've been working on with Highwire Games, Golem, Echoes of the First Dreamer. So let's start with that. How did you get the idea for writing prequel music?
Well, I had had the idea for writing prequel music back when we were working on Destiny, and actually that came about because we realized that switching from, you know, more than a decade of working on Halo and then switching to a completely new IP, Destiny, basically I was erasing access to 10 years worth of music that we had, you know, created and had in our library to use at any point we wanted. So I was like trying to figure out a way to get some music created up front before the game was playable and before we necessarily knew a lot about what Destiny was going to be. So I came up with the concept of Music of the Spheres and worked on that with Mike Salvatore and Paul McCartney, and we spent about 2 years working on that. Unfortunately, for reasons outside of my ability to control, we never actually released Music of the Spheres to the public. So I had this, like, you know, nice idea of doing a musical prequel to a game and actually not ever releasing it as a prequel. Most of that music ended up in Destiny and things related to Destiny. So, but it was never actually released in a way that was like a standalone experience where you heard, you know, 50 minutes of eight movements all in one, you know, sitting. So when I started working with Jamie Griesmer here at Highwire Games, he said, hey, why don't we do that? Why don't we try that again? And I said, okay, well, but this time I want to make sure it actually happens. So, and thus the Kickstarter. By doing a Kickstarter, that means really it's in my control. It's up to me to finish it. It's up to me and the guys to, you know, release it and get the T-shirts out and all the rest of it. We're not depending on anybody else making decisions about the product itself. So that's why we're doing it this way.
It's a really exciting project, and it looks like you're going to wrap it up successfully. And when I was talking with Mike Salvatore about the music in Destiny, he said that whenever you guys got stuck writing music for Halo, one of the Halo games, you could always like go back and recycle something, but you didn't have that safety net in Destiny.
Yeah,
and so exactly. Now you're really, really working without a safety net, it sounds like.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's fun about that is it's always interesting to start with some themes that have already like resonated with people. So with Halo, we had this this first theme that was written in 1999, and like Mike said, we could always sort of dip back into, is there any part of that theme that we haven't really mined yet? And every once in a while, you get a little inspiration from, you know, some little turn of phrase or melody or theme that was even in that first thing or anything that came out of that. It was actually fun to say, okay, we're starting from scratch, blank slate. Let's create themes that will be a rich, you know, gold mine, hopefully, of material for a long time to come. So I'm in that same position again. I'm sitting here going, okay, well, I've got the first thing that I did for the trailer, and now I've also got this sort of nice piano version of this thing, and I've got some other ideas. And what usually happens is it just sort of builds on itself. You just keep writing and finding little things that you like, and then you start doing variations on that.
Thank you.
what's different about it this time is that I'm in a sort of a different headspace. We're not saving the universe. It's not a legitimately sci-fi. It's much more of a mythical place with some magic. It's more character-driven story. So that's where I'm starting, and we'll see what happens. I'm excited about it, but also a little fear and trepidation because I haven't written it all yet.
Well, you've mentioned that one of your greatest sources of inspiration is having a deadline. So, but I'm also, you know, kind of curious about, you know, as you are getting ready to start a new project, and as you said, you've got some ideas swimming around in your brain. Is there often like just a key that kind of unlocks everything and kind of gets you rolling?
Yeah, you know, sometimes it could be just a snippet of a melody or a feeling. Sometimes it's a mode or some sort of a scale that I decide this is going to be the go-to scale. It doesn't mean that everything is written in that scale or that mode, but it's sort of like, for example, the Halo was based on a monk chant that was written, and I decided to do Dorian as a mode. So it was one of those nice things where Dorian was always this place I could come back to, and that sort of represented Halo. When we worked on Halo Reach, I thought, I think I want to make Reach a little darker and edgier, so I went with the Phrygian mode. And you know, these are like sort of technical things for music theory composition majors or whatever. It's not that the audience necessarily gets it, but there are different feelings to the modes, as you know. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I just like to have a mode that I stay within. And it's just a little bit different necessarily. I still do, major and minor and atonal and stuff like that, but I like to have sort of the main theme is a certain mode. So for example, right now there's a real nice Lydian feel to the first piece that I've been working on for Golem, and immediately that just gives you a different sense than Dorian, so, or Phrygian.
Well, it kind of plays back to the idea. Well, first of all, with modes, the whole steps and half steps don't line up the way they do with like the traditional scales that, you know, Mozart and Bach and Haydn and everybody else had used. So it does kind of give you a richer palette. But it also, what you're saying about the modes kind of plays into the idea that a lot of these composers had, that each key has a really definite personality.
It does. And actually, my wife, Marcy, has perfect pitch. And also, she's what they call synesthetic, I think it is.
Right, with the colors.
Yeah, so yeah. She has definite colors. So each note, each key has these colors that are consistent for her. And I just find that fascinating because I have just sort of a generalized feeling about keys and but nothing that necessarily stays, you know, super consistent. But my wife does. So that's really fun to sort of see what that's like.
Well, I guess, Sibelius had it too. And when he was having his home built just outside of Helsinki, he wanted the tiles to be a particular shade of green because for him that was D major. And the firer who made these tiles kept getting it like a little bit off. And apparently it just drove him crazy.
Well, you know, what's funny, I have looked into this a little bit because I thought, wow, this would be really amazing if like all these synesthetic perfect pitch composers and musicians had the same colors, and they don't. It's not even close. The colors are different for each person. So each person has their very specific set of colors, but they're not consistent between the people. So I think my wife is, well, I don't know. See, I can't remember what her colors are, but D, I don't think, is blue. Is that what you said, blue?
It was green.
Oh, it was green. I think she's blue.
Oh, okay.
That's right. I think she's blue. That's right, because when you said D, I was thinking blue.
Hmm.
Anyway, who knows? It's a little bit weird.
But it's certainly an interesting way, because you know, composers talk all the time about color in music. And to have it in a very literal literal color must be just incredible.
Well, I've actually asked her about that, and certainly, and it's interesting when she's listening to music she can't turn the colors off in her head. So the colors just sort of swirl in her head as she's listening. And so I've said, what are you seeing? What are you seeing? And she'll start trying to describe it. And it's seems pretty trippy to me. I think it would be a blast, but I don't have it at all. But I do have, there are senses of the emotions and feelings you get just from certain keys. And, you know, E flat major feels a certain way. I don't know why, but there you go.
Yeah, no, it's a really, really interesting way of approaching music. And last night we had, sounds kind of nerdy, but we had a Marty O'Donnell listening party, me and my son and my husband. And because we've all been fans of music for years and we have it all. And what was so fun was listening to, you know, one of the cues that you wrote for Myth 2. And then that would remind somebody of, oh my gosh, it sounds like this part of Reach or Destiny. And but what it really illustrated, I guess, is what a consistent voice you've had through your career, even though you're writing music for all these different kinds of games, really.
Well, I appreciate hearing that you say it's some sort of nice, consistent voice. It could also be considered kind of stale and boring, I guess. I don't do it on purpose necessarily, but you know, when I see people say, oh, I just love this one piece that you wrote, you know, whatever, 10 years ago, and it reminds me of this piece you just did like 2 years ago. And I have to go, oh, yeah, I forgot completely about the piece 10 years ago. It probably just came from the same little part of my brain, and it's just something I like or whatever. The same thing happens, I know, with Mike. And Mike and I have worked together for so many years that sometimes I'll sit trying to get a new idea and I'll think, what would Mike do? Because it's sort of like I try to put myself not in my head, but in Mike's head. And then, you know, I'll sometimes show it to Mike and he'll be, wow, I would have done that. I'm like, yes, I'm successful. And of course, he's done the exact same thing. He'll sit there and start doing something and I listen to it and I'm like, wow, who are you channeling there? And he says, you. So.
Well, and I know obviously there are a lot of classical composers that you really admire. And do you ever get to the point where you think, well, what would Prokofiev have done?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting you would say that because actually with Golem and Echoes of the First Dreamer, because it's a smaller, more intimate sort of story, and I want to sort of keep things a little more contained than the last thing I did for Destiny, which was really big and had a lot of big stuff in it. I was just thinking about Erik Satie, and I love his stuff. He had no problem in the middle of the height of the Romantic era where everything was Wagnerian and you know, overblown. And he just did these just beautiful little simple but incredibly tasty pieces. And I thought, you know, we'll see. Maybe I'll have some of that. And so I'm not sure if I'm really channeling Satie, but I'm saying, what's wrong with that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, Steve Jobs said, if you're going to steal, steal from the best.
Well, and it's not so much, see, like I agree with that, but you don't want to steal necessarily as be inspired. Mm-hmm. So, like, there's an inspirational part, and you know when you're crossing the line, when you're actually just copying chunks of something and trying to, you know, you have a pastiche effect. And I think people sort of sense that. They listen to it, and they're like, it doesn't speak to them. So in some way, you know, you're immersed in music, you have music that you love, and then when you try to go inside and find something new, it still has to speak to you in a way that... even though it might come from this, you know, hodgepodge of things that are in your head that you've grown up with or you love, it still has to have a new sense to it. Like Schumann said, in order to compose, you have to remember a tune that no one's written
yet. That's the hard part. And that's what strikes me as being so magical about a composer, because I've got melodies from everybody else in my head, but I can't think of one, you know, that's completely brand new. And so that's why I have just so much admiration for people like you who can do that and keep coming up with new ideas.
Well, see, there you go. There, you just scared me again, because now I'm like, well, maybe the well is dry. Maybe there's nothing left. Oh,
I don't think so. I mean, the little bits of music that you sent me for Golem that we'll listen to don't sound like that at all. And you've mentioned that one of your goals with the music for The First Dreamer, and I would imagine for Golem too, is to create something on a much more intimate scale than you've been able to do with Halo and Destiny. And
Yes.
so I can really understand why Satie, it's the style of Satie with its simplicity and its melodies that it would be just such a fabulous source of inspiration for that.
Yeah, that's where I'm at.
Well, let's talk just a little bit, the little bit we know, those of us in the public, about the story of Golem, because it sounds like it does lend itself to a completely different style of music. It's a young girl who's been injured, can't walk, but she can create these monsters, these stone monsters, these golems, and kind of experience the world through them. Is that right?
Right. I don't think this has been clarified before, so I'll do it now. I don't think it's going to hurt at all. But actually, the story is just a little bit, it's the story about siblings. What you've seen so far is the sister, and you'll be playing as the younger sibling, and we're going to give you the choice of whether you feel comfortable as as the younger brother or the younger sister. So you're actually be playing as the younger sibling, and what you've seen in the trailer is actually the older sister, and so she's the one who had the ability, and now you are learning that. And essentially, I don't want to give too much away, but you have been injured and you are confined to your bedroom, and you realize that you have the abilities that your older sister had, to control the dolls in the room or the action figures in the room, and then you discover a way of getting more and more powerful until you eventually have and you control and build these 20-foot tall stone giants. These golems that you control have a lot to do with the place you live and the mysterious hidden city, forbidden city, that is also being patrolled by stone golems. So you have a quest, you have a reason to go exploring, and you end up having to fight these things. So I don't want to give too much away about the story, but I think it's going to be pretty interesting. You're going to find out about your relationship with your sister, and why you live where you live, and your father and mother, and stuff like that. But it's never going to turn into anything where suddenly now you have to save the entire world, or you have to save the galaxy, or whatever. I mean, it just is going to stay sort of this nice, intimate, but magically mystical story. So,
And it sounds like you're going to have a lot of opportunities for writing real emotional music too, and creating some really kind of
yes,
tender moments too. So.
I really hope so. Yeah, that is the point. That's the thing. Jamie and I, Jamie worked, of course, on Halo for years as a designer, and I worked along with him since we were in Chicago together in the 90, late 90s. And then he ended up going to work on Infamous Second Son. And that was another, pretty big game. It was a AAA studio, and it had a pretty big story to it, in terms of, the consequences of what you were doing. And we just thought it would be fun to try to stay more contained, and where the story is about, you and your family and the surrounding world that you're in. And it's a smaller, the stakes are still high, right? I mean, the stakes are still life and death and saving, your family, but it never gets bigger than that. So.
It sounds absolutely fascinating. And one thing that we haven't even touched on is that this is going to be released for the PlayStation for their VR. And so, does that pose any challenges for the music that you're writing, or is it more of a challenge for sound design?
For me right now, and we'll see if I'm right, I believe that the challenge is almost entirely in the sound design area. But there is sort of a challenge with how do you tell story and involve the player in you know, story moments when they're immersed in a world and they can turn and look at anything they want and do whatever they want to. We have decided not to take away control. We haven't really even decided exactly how we're going to handle this entirely. But for the most part, we feel like we have a pretty good handle on telling a story in virtual reality without taking control away from the player.
It sounds almost like the same challenges that you have with an open world, where
yes.
you don't know really what the player's going to be doing at any given moment.
Right. So to that extent, you have to sort of funnel them into areas where they really kind of can't get away from the story you're trying to tell. And, you know, in traditional, you know, you lock the door behind somebody and you know, force them to only have one way to really look. Everything else is boring. So essentially that's the kind of thing you end up doing. Or you make something so compelling that they have to look at it, at what you're trying to show them.
I would hope that that's the goal, and nobody who's playing the game ends up feeling kind of trapped and, gee, I wish I
right.
could go through that door.
It magically opens after the scene is done.
Uh-huh. You know, speaking of sound design, that is one of the real high watermarks, I think, that's the sound design that you did for first of all, Myst and Riven. Those games just would not be the games they are without the sound design.
Thanks a lot, but I can't take credit for Myst. Myst is the game that actually got me interested in doing sound design, and I got to do the sequel, which was Riven.
Thank you. Thank you for setting that straight. But my comment still stands.
Okay.
Riven just wouldn't have been the incredible game that it is without the sound design, because that's the thing that really brings the world alive, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And what was fun, too, was so many of the puzzles in Riven and Myst, but the puzzles I got to work on in Riven were driven by what the audio was. So that was a lot of fun, too. It was important to the actual gameplay.
And the sound that you created for the Halo series is just astonishing. I mean, one of my favorite things to do is to open up a multiplayer map just all by myself and wander around and listen to the story. Because it's such, you don't get to hear that if you're in the midst of, you know, fighting through Covenant and, you know, waves and waves of gunfire. But you put so much attention to detail and so much care into each one of those areas, each one of those maps, to really make them seem like places you could go.
That's great. I'm glad I'm glad somebody does that, because I, of course, I do that. And, you know, I've always had a team of people working with me, although when we first started working on things like this, Riven and Myth, it was back in Chicago, and it was basically just Mike and myself, and then we ended up hiring another sound designer. But my philosophy really does come from the idea that whatever you're, you know, the sounds are going to make it real. And in order for it to become so real, the sounds will end up just disappearing, because you don't feel any differently walking around inside of one of these environments than you do walking around in the world. The sounds should just make it seem like they're natural and real. But for those people who go, wait a minute, somebody had to do this. Like, well, what is this? And take the time to actually notice all the details. I'm glad somebody does that, because I think that really helps. What usually jerks me out of game is sound that seems inappropriate or is repetitive or annoying, and then I become aware of the sound in a way that's not good, and I want to always make sure that we don't do that. So,
well, the range of sounds in Halo is really brilliant, because there's like foreground and background sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you always know when your shields are coming back, that's a really present sound. And it, in some cases, kind of even overrides the sound of the gun. And it, so clearly, a lot of thought, as you say, went into this. But it's so subtle that you almost don't notice it unless you stop and kind of pick it all apart.
Well, that's interesting. The classifications of sound like that are really important to us because we have what we call gameplay sounds, sounds that are really important to gameplay. Like, we want people to know that they just picked up ammunition, which means it needs to be the same sound every time because it's giving them a confirmation of what they did. But you want to have random non-repetitive sounds for the environment and for what seems more real and is less attached to gameplay itself. So, the idea of your shields going down and your shields coming back up, that needs to have a very consistent sound, certainly, hopefully not annoying, but consistent. But, the sounds of, the metal scraping when you're driving the Warthog and you run into rocks or something, you have to have a huge pile of random different kind of sounds that are have a lot of variety in them. Otherwise, they'll get real repetitive and that'll call attention to itself. So there's different categories and anyway, that's we do think a lot about that. You're right.
Yeah, and it shows. I mean, it's one of the things I think that has given Halo such an incredibly huge and dedicated fan base, and also Destiny. I mean, and people are still playing Myth 1 and Myth 2, which is really just so cool.
Wow, that's amazing because I don't even know how to play those games now, but apparently there are ways to do it and they're out there, so that's great.
Yeah, no, they've been ported. I don't know, Good Old Games or somebody found a way to do it so that you can still do like multiplayer. And so,
Oh,
so
that's great. I
I
did run into some fans a couple of years ago who were describing to me how they sort of reversed engineered and they got the sound engine and the what we called sound tags for everything in Myth, and they were asking me questions about these little details that I put in, whatever, 17 years ago. And I was astounded at how much they knew about what I had done, and I completely forgot. So it's pretty cool that there's a community out there doing
Oh yeah. Well, you're doing things in the now and
that.
creating new stuff. So,
I gotta make a living,
yeah,
yes.
right. One of the composers I talked with a little while ago has also had a really long career. He started in the 90s, and I asked him if there was anything he missed about writing music and being part of making games in the 90s, and his immediate answer was, well, no. But he was mostly talking about the technology and how really ancient it is. But I'm wondering if there's anything that you miss about that era in making games.
Well, it certainly was exciting because it felt to me at that time like every project, and of course, I feel like I was kind of late to the party. I didn't work on my first game until 96, and we released Riven and Myth in the fall of 97. So by that point, there had already been, a long history of games and a lot of progress was made. But as I look back on it, I realized that was a really important little period of time where the technology got better. You had a lot more storage space and you had better fidelity. It was a big deal to be able to do 16-bit, which means that the sound itself wasn't all crackly and horrible, and stereo. You could almost have CD quality sound, even with the sound effects, not just Redbook audio streaming off of a CD, but you could have music and sound and a real mix. And it was just beginning then, and you didn't have a lot of room. You didn't have a lot of RAM to work with, but you had enough to show that the future was there. The future was going to be eventually, we're not going to be constrained by number of voices we can use or fidelity or anything else. And that developed actually pretty quickly. So if I miss anything, it's like I don't know that the speed of improvement has, I guess, sort of plateaued a little bit. We don't have, I mean, I don't see the user's not going to, if we suddenly start shipping it at 24-bit, 96 kilohertz, I don't think the user's going to hear really any different. So what I think the next big hurdle to jump over is really specific three-dimensional 3D audio so that you really hear things in a 360-degree sphere around your head. And there's some new technology that I think is just starting to be played with that allows that to happen using speakers rather than headphones. But headphones and HRTF for 3D, and then, you know, anything that allows a really pinpoint control over the placement of three-dimensional audio is the next big thing. But we don't have, I can't just go out and say, hey, listen, I recorded an orchestra and it sounds just like a record. That was a big deal in 1999, right, for games. Mm-hmm. There weren't a lot of games that had that. So you could be sort of one of the first to the party with just that, and people would be impressed. That doesn't impress anybody anymore.
No, it's a much higher bar. And then, of course, there's always that pesky thing called a story that you can't really leave behind.
Yes.
Well, I've just got two last questions.
Sure.
Do you remember who the narrator was in the Myth games?
Oh, certainly. His name was Jeffrey Charlton Perrin. He was an actual client of ours. We did, as you know, we did commercials. And he was a creative director at an agency. And he was a really good writer, too. So he would, a lot of times, would come over and either narrate or do the voiceover on the demo of some commercial he wanted to do. And every once in a while, he would actually do the final voiceover. So we always knew that Jeffrey had this wonderful voice, and he was British.
Mm-hmm.
So we were friends with him. And then when the guys at Bungie said we need to have, they wanted to use Patrick McGoohan, they had just seen him as the old king in Braveheart. And I said, yeah, you know, that might be kind of hard to get Patrick McGoohan, but as a demo, let me use this guy I know and see if that's going to work for the narration. So I brought Jeffrey in, and he read down like the first, you know, story chunk. And everybody at Bungie said, well, gee, that guy's great. Why should we replace him? And I'm like, yeah, right. So yeah. Jeffrey did the whole thing, and he was a blast to work with. I really enjoyed him.
I bet. Well, his narrations, those journal entries, just added so much, and somebody put them all together just in a whole sweeping thing, and it's...
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's incredible, because then you get the whole sense of this epic story, just one right after the other, and you can realize how...
Interesting. I should listen to that, because I think the other thing maybe not that many people know is originally Bungie... it just said, all we need is the narration. And I said, look, the narration is going to be really dry. You know, let me put some music behind it. So we wrote a little piece of music for the first demo and had it so there was music under Jeffrey's journal narration. And then the guys at Bungie heard it and they were like, wow, that's great. Can we just repeat that, you know, 20 more times? And I'm like, no. The reason it works is because we're scoring this little story and we need to score it, you know, 20 more times.
Tuesday, September 2nd, near Braille. When we reached Tallow, Rorik told the mayor he had overheard the brigands speaking of taking corpses to a castle near the town of Braille. Indeed, the locals we encountered on the way said they had seen many wagons filled with bodies being hauled into the keep. The master of this castle is Baron Kildare. We were joined at Tallow by reinforcements to attack the Baron's stronghold and put an end to his unwholesome trade in human remains. This evening at our camp, just outside the keep, I was awakened by a low rumbling. We watched in helpless silence as a massive army of Thrall, 10 abreast and 100 deep, marched out of the main gate heading south. Kruniak fears their destination is Tallow, and has sent a runner to warn the town. I cannot help but feel somewhat relieved. We should meet little or no resistance tomorrow instead of facing hundreds upon hundreds of Thrall. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said for Tallow.
Anyway, it was a slow learning process for them, although they jumped right on it. But it almost didn't happen that way. Originally, it was just going to be scrolling text with no voice.
Oh.
And then they decided, well, we'll just have voice. And then I was able to convince them to do voice and music.
Yeah.
To a certain extent, that's something else I missed. There was, at the time, you're working with these people who were just eager and young, and there were areas especially in the storytelling and presentation, how to present something elegantly that they just didn't have experience with. So it was really easy to just show them a few, you know, tricks of the trade to make things way better. And now when I look at the games, the production values are so high. You know, they rival the production values in anything, including movies and television. So I don't have my little tricks of the trade don't blow anybody away anymore.
But still, you know, it why not make it as polished as you can instead of just, you know, sliding something under the door and saying here.
Exactly.
Well, and the other thing I was really wondering about is now you started your own studio, Highwire Games. And I'm just wondering, what are some of the things that you really love about having your very own studio and your very own small team of colleagues?
Well, you know, you go from... I always had a small studio in Chicago that was a music production company. So it was just Mike and myself. And, you know, every once in a while we hire some other people in to help out. But when we started working, you know, Bungie was a client. And then when I joined Bungie as the full-time audio director, there weren't more than, you know, 28 or 35 people. I forget what it was at the beginning. And so at that point, it was small enough that not only everybody had a voice, but everybody had, you know, specific impact. Their decisions really meant something. And I just felt for myself, by the time we got up to, you know, a couple of years ago, and there was, I think there was at least 600 people there at the time when I left, it just felt like there was way more decision makers in the mix all the time. It was a lot harder to get things from beginning to end and seeing what your impact was going to be. Hmm. Now you go back to, you know, a small team of 10, 11 people, and suddenly like everybody has a huge impact and every decision is like, we can run with it. And, you know, there's no second guessing. There's no tomorrow. So everything is a lot more, you know, close to the bone. Like you make it and then you got to live with it. And there's not a whole lot of other people that like turn around and blame. It's just you and, you know, these 10 other people. So that makes it really exciting. I think I like that better. It also means you're suddenly realizing that you don't have the infrastructure around you to, you know, to do PR and marketing and promotional, you know, things. So, you go, oh, that's right. We used to have a whole division of the company that just handled that stuff. And now it's just us. So it's fun. It's more exciting. Our slogan is old dogs, new tricks. And it's not just referring to the fact that we have a lot of veterans and experience, but we're excited about doing something new. And VR is new. And also working in a small independent studio is a new experience for a lot of us. So,
well, we're all waiting for the game to come out. And I, Marty, it's just been an absolute joy to talk with you. Really fascinating. And I want to wish you good luck with Echoes of the First Dreamer, too, because that's sort of like the opening salvo, I guess.
It is. And thanks, Kate. I appreciate that you are going to tell people about that and tell them that they still have time to support the Kickstarter, and it'll help.